Hello, this is John Cleese, and you're listening to the Podcast Network.
Welcome to the No Illusions Podcast, recorded August 31st, 2011.
But if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.
It will be podcast.
My name's Cameron Riley. Thank you for tuning in to the show. Welcome to any first-time listeners and welcome back to old-time listeners. You realise I've been doing the show, or a variation on it anyway, from G'day World through to this now since November 2004. I can't even work out how many years that is. Nearly seven years I've been doing this show. And what do I have to show for it? Nothing. Not a thing, apart from you lovely listeners. So keep tuning in there while we keep the faith. Try and do some good in the world by talking about the news that doesn't really make the 6 o'clock headlines. Starting off with this week's story, I want to talk about something called the conservative white male effect, the CWM. Got this, sirens, hope they're not coming for me. I don't know if you can hear that in the background. I got this from the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia a couple of weeks ago. It says, when it comes to climate change, most people have heard of the greenhouse effect, but what about the conservative white male effect? A US-based study has found that white men with politically conservative views are far more likely than the rest of the population to doubt the science of human-caused climate change. And the conservative white male effect has been linked to Australia, with one prominent researcher citing the existence of a successful, politically engaged and outspoken coterie operating in high-profile positions that attract wide media coverage. I don't know about you guys, but I have conversations with CWMs on a regular basis about climate change, and it's a fascinating experience. Because, they'll say, I just don't believe that humans are responsible for climate change. I say, okay, well, why not? Take me through the science. Oh, I just don't believe it. Yeah, okay, but why not? Oh, well, the Earth's really old and I just don't believe it. Just doesn't make sense to me. I say, well, take me through which part of the science doesn't make sense to you. Well, I haven't read it. It just doesn't make sense. That's about the level of argument that I tend to get from conservative white males. Anyway, in the US researcher's paper, it was published in the journal Global Environmental Change, Dr. Aaron McWright and Dr. Riley Dunlap analyzed data from 10 US annual opinion polls on environmental issues. They found, here's the key numbers, 58% of conservative white males thought recent global temperature rises were not caused mainly from human activities, such as burning fossil fuels. This compared with 31% of other adults. So 58% of conservative white males are climate change deniers, but only 31% of other adults. That's a big deal. It's almost double. Some 29% of CWMs thought the effects of global warming would never happen, compared with only 7% of other adults. So what's that? Almost 400%. That's a big jump. So what is it about conservative white males that means that they are so far removed from the rest of the population? Well, according to Dr. Kelly Fielding, a senior researcher at the University of Queensland's Institute for Social Science Research, she said political affiliation was strongly linked to climate change beliefs. She was part of a research project which last year surveyed more than 300 Australian political leaders. Only 38% of Liberal national politicians thought humans were causing global warming, compared to 89% from Labor. I'm surprised that they got 38% of Liberal national politicians to actually say that, honestly. And there was another survey done by Professor Reza, a national survey last year of more than 3,000 Australians, which found 90% of respondents accepted humans were playing a causal role in climate change. Less than 6% could really be classified as strong disbelievers, he said. There were also There was also a distinct gender divide, with more women willing to accept the scientific evidence, which means that women are smarter than men. So there you go. 90% of respondents believe that humans played a causal role, which equates with 89% of Labour politicians surveyed. You know, they're pretty much in touch with what the general population believe, but only 38% of Liberal national politicians believe that humans play a causal role in global warming. Where is the disconnect? You know, if you're not going to accept the science, here's my perspective for what it's worth. Here's my 5 cents. When you're dealing with issues that involve science, you have two choices. You either accept the consensus of the scientists working in this field, the scientists that are actively publishing in this specialist field, you accept their consensus, or you don't. Or you go, well, screw the scientists, they don't know what they're talking about. Now, that, you know, may be true. Maybe the scientists are wrong. Maybe they are misled. Maybe they have an agenda. Maybe they've been bought. These things are possible and can happen. But here's my premise. If you're going to make the case that one of those things is happening, you have to provide evidence for that. If you think the entire scientific community has got it wrong, you have to have some sort of convincing, compelling evidence to back up that argument. If you don't, then you're just blowing smoke at your ass. And, you know, if you're a climate change denier, if you're denying the scientific consensus on something like this, you are really no different from creationists. You're no different from the people that believe the Earth is 6,000 years old. You're just picking and choosing, throwing the science out when it doesn't conform to your particular political ideology or religious beliefs, and saying, well, you know, I don't like where that goes, so I'm just going to ignore it. And really, it's in terms of intellectual ethics, it puts you in the same category as creationists. Speaking of religion, leads me on to my next story. A study has reportedly found that religion is set for extinction in 9 countries. Those 9 countries are Australia, Austria, Canada, Czech Republic, Finland, Ireland, Netherlands, New Zealand, and Switzerland. This study was presented at an American Physical Society meeting in Dallas, Texas, recently. The study is titled Modeling the Decline of Religion, and it was presented by Richard Weiner, W-I-E-N-E-R, from the University of Arizona, Haley Yapple from the Northwestern University, and Daniel Abrams from Northwestern University. And it points out that societies in which the perceived utility of not adhering is greater than the utility of adhering, religion will be driven toward extinction. People claiming no religious affiliation constitute the fastest growing religious minority in many countries throughout the world. It is said that in the Czech Republic, about 60% of people identify themselves as non-affiliated to religion. Now, the last time I saw numbers in Australia, I think we're up around about 25%. But hopefully with the latest census that has just been done here, we're going to bump up again. So that's all I have to say on that. It's a positive sign in terms of the decline of religion, at least in some countries. Of course, missing from that list, which sort of surprised me, was the United Kingdom. I would have thought that the United Kingdom was a fairly secular country these days. Certainly that's what I hear. But good to see Australia and New Zealand on that list with some terrific Scandinavian and European countries, and shout out to our Commonwealth brothers and sisters in Canada. Got nothing to do with religion, but cigars is about as close to religion as I get these days. There's a study that goes back a couple of years, goes back to 2008, but I saw Dave Weiner, I think, actually tweeted recently, and so I saved it again because in light of the plain packaging legislation that's being in the process of being passed here in Australia, the lower house approved the legislation in the last week without any complaint from either of the major parties. and it's going in front of the upper house, I think, in the next couple of weeks. And one of the arguments that's being used for pushing through the tobacco plain packaging legislation is the cost of tobacco-related illness in Australia. Now, I should point out a couple of things. Number one, I do not believe there is any evidence to show that cigars have anywhere near the health effects that cigarettes do, and for a number of reasons. Number one, cigars are just natural tobacco. There's no chemicals, and cigarettes have something like 400 chemicals in them, I think. And secondly, you don't inhale cigars, so it doesn't get down into your lungs and it doesn't do the amount of damage that cigarettes do. The other thing is that the numbers that the government are putting out are dodgy. So the Australian government's saying that it costs the Australian economy, that the tobacco-related illness costs the Australian economy somewhere in the vicinity of $31.5 billion a year. Sounds like a lot of money. But when you actually break it down, the actual health care costs are around about $300 million. $300 million out of $31.5 billion. Where's the other $31.2 billion? Oh, well, that's what they call lost productivity in the workplace, which is like the dodgiest thing I've ever seen. You know, it just goes to show that they can't put together really a valid argument for this. Anyway, so this study goes back to 2008. It was a Dutch study, and it says that it costs more to care for healthy people who live years longer than it does to have people that are suffering from obesity or lung cancer. The paper was published in the Public Library of Science Medicine Journal, and Dutch researchers found that the health costs of thin and healthy people in adulthood are more expensive than those of either fat people or smokers. They created a model to simulate lifetime health costs for three groups of 1,000 people, the healthy living group, thin and non-smoking, obese people, and smokers. The model relied on cost of illness data and disease prevalence in the Netherlands in 2003. The researchers found that from age 20 to 56, obese people racked up the most expensive health costs. But because both the smokers and the obese people died sooner than the healthy group, it cost less to treat them in the long run. On average, healthy people lived 84 years, smokers lived about 77 years, and obese people lived about 80 years. Smokers and obese people tended to have more heart disease than the healthy people. Cancer incidence, except for lung cancer, was the same in all three groups. Obese people had the most diabetes and healthy people had the most strokes. Ultimately, the thin and healthy group cost the most, about $417,000 from age 20 onwards. Here's the summary. The cost of care for obese people was $371,000 and for smokers about $326,000. So those numbers again. Smokers cost about $326,000 from the age 20 onwards. Obese people, $371,000. And thin, healthy people, 417,000 people. Because they live longer and you have to pay for their medicines and their health cares and that kind of stuff. And they suffer from strokes. So the whole economic argument that the Australian government is trying to put forward for this plain packaging legislation is just bogus on many levels. What's really going on? Why are they really going to all the trouble? Well, I think it's just an easy win. About 16% of Australians smoke in one form or another today. Cigar smokers are like less than 1% of that. But when you've got only 16%, that means 84% of the population doesn't really give a shit what you do to smokers. In fact, you know, they probably get a little bit of Schadenfreude, I think I pronounced that right, when smokers get beaten up on. So it's an easy win for a political party to say, oh, yes, you know, we're beating up on those nasty smokers and we're beating up on those evil tobacco companies. So it's really just political point scoring, I think. It's something that you can put in the look what we did, we are so brave and bold category, when really it's a waste of time and money. The big concern, though, if you're an Australian, even if you're not a smoker and you don't give a shit what happens to smokers or cigarette companies, is the precedence that it's setting here. So the government is saying, well, we've decided that this thing is bad for you, So we're going to mandate that they can have no logos, no branding, no marketing. Everything needs to be in a, if you haven't been following it, all, if this legislation passes, and it looks like it will, all tobacco products, when they come into the country, will have to be in government-regulated plain packaging. It'll be an olive green box with no logos, no special typefaces or fonts, government-mandated, just saying cigarettes or tobacco or cigars on them. What if this gets through and then they push it out to alcohol? Imagine going into a bottle shop and having every bottle of alcohol in a plain olive green box where they all look the same and you can't tell quickly what's what. Or imagine that McDonald's or pizzas or your car, they decide your car is dangerous, so every car has to be the same olive green car, so they can't use, and the same design, because the argument is that tobacco companies use marketing to entice people to use their products. You know, you could say the same for all of the other categories of products that I've mentioned. I mean, imagine Australia looking like that 10, 20 years from now. Kind of reminds me of Russia under Stalin. Is this really the nanny state that we want to turn into? Don't people have enough intelligence to decide what products they want to use and what they don't? I'm all for the government providing education and awareness, but when the government starts to mandate what products we can buy and what we can't, or starts to mandate how companies are allowed to market their products, I think that's overstepping the mark. What about you? And on to business and economic, financial news, that kind of stuff. Great article that was in Al Jazeera recently called "Is Capitalism Doomed?" I'll just cut to the crux here. Talks about all the problems that capitalist countries from Greece and other European countries, the United Kingdom, the United States, are facing at the moment. This article, by the way, is not written by a hack. It's written by Nouriel Roubini, who's the chairman of Roubini Global Economics, professor of economics at the Stern School of Business, New York University, and co-author of the book Crisis Economics. He says, Karl Marx, it seems, was partly right in arguing that globalization, financial intermediation run amok, and redistribution of income and wealth from labor to capital would lead capitalism to self-destruct. Firms are cutting jobs because there's not enough final demand, but cutting jobs reduces labor income, increases inequality, and reduces financial demand. Recent popular demonstrations from the Middle East to Israel to the UK and rising popular anger in China, and soon enough in other advanced economies in emerging markets, are all driven by the same issues and tensions: growing inequality, poverty, unemployment, and hopelessness. Even the world's middle classes are feeling the squeeze of falling incomes and opportunities. You don't hear the mainstream media, interestingly enough, this is just a sideline by me here, when it's talking about the riots and the protests in the United Kingdom, in London recently. You don't really hear them put it in that terms. You have to really dig deep into, you know, left or activist media to find them framing the London protests in terms of financial inequality, poverty, unemployment rates, hopelessness, these sort of the breaking of the social contract, as I talked about on the last show. Usually, you know, if they're talking about the protests in the Middle East, in the Arab nations, the Arab Spring, they're happy to use those sorts of terms. But when they're talking about London, it's just a bunch of thugs and hoodlums. You know, they get basically, they're written off because nobody, like particularly the mainstream media, doesn't want to admit that capitalism in developed countries, Western democracies, is broken. Article goes on, to enable market-oriented economies to operate as they should and can, we need to return to the right balance between markets and provision of public goods. That means moving away from both the Anglo-Saxon model of laissez-faire and voodoo economics and the continental European model of deficit-driven welfare states. Both are broken. The right balance today requires creating jobs partly through additional fiscal stimulus aimed at productive infrastructure investment. It also requires more progressive taxation, more short-term fiscal stimulus with medium and long-term fiscal discipline, lender of last resort support by monetary authorities to prevent ruinous runs on banks, reduction of the debt burden for insolvent households and other distressed economic agents, and stricter supervision and regulation of a financial system run amok, breaking up too big to fail banks and oligopolistic trusts. Which sounds like a fairly sensible balance between the Reaganomics approach that the US in particular and also the UK and Australia and countries like that have been trying to push versus more socialistic countries, not that many of those exist today. You need to invest in public infrastructure. You need to invest in keeping people productively employed with good education and good healthcare. And that's, you know, the Ayn Rand view of that as being charity or as being a handout is actually misleading, I think. Yeah, if you're part of the wealthy elite, and I know some of the listeners to this show are part of the wealthy elite, that we have quite a few millionaires who listen to this show. You know, you need to think about this in terms of your self-interest. If we run a society where the majority of the population are broke, unemployed, don't have health care, can't educate their kids, don't have any hope of financial security, we're going to find ourselves in the equivalent of Paris in 1794, 1795. You're going to have a revolution on your hands. And it was no good being rich and wealthy in France, in Paris, in the mid-1790s. Didn't matter how much money you had, you got your head chopped off. And that's basically what happens to societies when there's that level of financial inequality. Also happened during the Russian Revolution, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the West has been able to work out and maintain a reasonable balance over the majority of the last, 100 years in particular, since FDR's New Deal, of balancing the wealth that's generated for the elite in the capitalistic model with making sure that there's a healthy middle class and that the lower socioeconomic sectors of society at least have the basics taken care of. But that seems to be fracturing at the moment. And if we allow that to fracture or continue to fracture, we're going to have trouble on our hands. Talking about bailouts, there's a story in Bloomberg during the week about how much money the big banks in the US actually were handed. This was kept secret for the last few years, but it's recently come out through Freedom of Information Act requests and litigation. Turns out that Citigroup and Bank of America were the reigning champions of finance in 2006 as home prices peaked, leading the 10 biggest U.S. banks and brokerage firms to their best year ever with $104 billion of profits. By 2008, the housing market's collapse forced those companies to take more than six times as much, $669 billion, in emergency loans from the U.S. Federal Reserve. The loans dwarfed the $160 billion in public bailouts the top 10 got from the U.S. Treasury, yet until now, the full amounts have remained secret. Federal Chairman Ben Bernanke's unprecedented effort to keep the economy from plunging into depression included lending banks and other companies as much as $1.2 trillion of public money, about the same amount U.S. homeowners currently owe on 6.5 million delinquent and foreclosed mortgages. The largest borrower, Morgan Stanley, got as much as $107.3 billion, while Citigroup took $99.5 billion and Bank of America $91.4 billion. Now, here's the interesting thing. I mean, there's a couple of interesting things that have come out of this. It says that 2 weeks after Lehman's bankruptcy in September 2008, Morgan Stanley countered concerns that it might be next to go by announcing that it had strong capital and liquidity positions. The statement in a September 29, 2008 press release about a $9 billion investment from Tokyo-based Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group said nothing about Morgan Stanley's federal loans. It was the same day as the firm's $107.3 billion peak in borrowing from the central bank, which was the source of almost all of Morgan Stanley's available cash. So Morgan Stanley's out there publicly saying that it's very financially liquid, but doesn't disclose that the reason it is financially liquid is because it's got a cheap loan from the government for $100 billion. Now, apparently, the rates that they were borrowing this money at, you might say, well, what's wrong with that? The rates that they were borrowing this money at was extremely discounted. They loaned out a lot of this money at a rate of 1.1%, which was about less than a third of the 3.8% the banks were charging each other at the time to make loans. So if you can borrow from the government $1 billion at 1% and then loan it out to somebody else, another bank at 3%, or loan it out to a member of the general public for, say, 4, 5, 6%, it's not hard to make a lot of money. You know, imagine if any business, if or any individual was given $1 million at a rate that was massively discounted to the market rate, you could turn that into serious money. You don't have to be any sort of financial genius. If you can borrow money at 1% and loan it out at 3, 4, 5%, you don't need to be a financial genius to turn that into a massive profit. And that's basically what these banks were given. You know, the US government is saying, well, you know, they paid back all of the loans and we made $13 billion in interest. Well, that's great. But, you know, why are these titans of Wall Street being given the opportunity to make billions of dollars of profit hand over fist like that? They're already the, you know, the wealthiest individuals in the country. They were basically just given pretty much free public money to make even more profit. You know, this is just the way that Wall Street works now. It's friends looking after friends looking after friends. Speaking of which, that leads me on to Matt Taibbi's recent article on the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission in the US. This is from August 17th. He says, imagine a world in which a man who was repeatedly investigated for a string of serious crimes but never prosecuted has his slate wiped clean every time the cops fail to make a case. No more Lifetime Channel specials where the murderer is unveiled after police stumble upon past intrigues in some old file. Hey, Chief, did you know this guy had two wives die falling down the stairs? No more burglary sprees cracked when some sharp cop sees the same name pop up in one too many witness statements. This is a different world, one far friendlier to lawbreakers, where even the suspicion of wrongdoing gets wiped from the record. That, it now appears, is exactly how the Securities and Exchange Commission has been treating the Wall Street criminals who cratered the global economy a few years back. For the past two decades, according to a whistleblower at the SEC who recently came forward to Congress, the agency has been systematically destroying records of its preliminary investigations once they're closed. Obviously, need a coffee. By whitewashing the files of some of the nation's worst financial criminals, the SEC has kept an entire generation of federal investigators in the dark about past inquiries into insider trading, fraud, and market manipulation against companies like Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, and AIG. With a few strokes of the keyboard, the evidence gathered during thousands of investigations, 18,000, including Madoff, as one high-ranking SEC official put it during a panicked meeting about the destruction, has apparently disappeared forever into the wormhole of history. So they were basically, you know, running these investigations. The investigations would get, you know, terminated for one reason or another. And all of the research that they did in these investigations would just get deleted. So there was no records trail, no paper trail about who said what and what was uncovered. Now, some really interesting stuff comes out of this as well as to how these investigations might get terminated. Back in 2000, there was a case the SEC were running against Deutsche Bank. It says a few years earlier, Rolf Brewer, the bank's CEO, had given an interview to Der Spiegel in which he denied that Deutsche was involved in takeover talks to acquire a rival American firm, Bankers Trust. But the statement was apparently untrue, and it sent the stock of Bankers Trust tumbling, potentially lowering the price for the merger. So the SEC suspected that the investors of Bankers Trust had been defrauded, and they opened a case. Well, the case was going along swimmingly. Then Deutsche hired a former SEC director to lobby the agency to back off. But it continued to go ahead, and it went up several levels of approval, and all it needed was the approval of the guy who was the director of enforcement at the SEC, Richard Walker. But then a curious thing happened. On July 10th, 2001, the investigators were informed that Walker was mysteriously recusing himself from the Deutsche case. 2 weeks later, on July 23rd, the enforcement division sent a letter to Deutsche that read, "Inquiry in the above-mentioned matter has been terminated. The bank was in the clear. The SEC was dropping its fraud investigation." In contradiction to the agency's usual practice, it provided no explanation for its decision to close the case. On October 1st of that year, so August, September, October, 3 months later, the mystery was solved. Dick Walker was named general counsel of Deutsche. Less than 10 weeks after the SEC shut down its investigation of the bank, the agency's director of enforcement was handed a cushy, high-priced job at Deutsche. And apparently this isn't the only time that's happened. There's this, like the Treasury in the US White House is a revolving door between senior officials at Goldman Sachs. It seems like senior investigators and directors of the Securities Exchange Commission end up going directly from the SEC to cushy jobs at major financial firms that they were dropping cases against previously. So this is just how the game works, folks. Let's not have any illusions about how corrupt Wall Street and the people that are supposed to be regulating Wall Street really are. When you see stories like this that just don't get a huge amount of press, they aren't well known, they get forgotten and dropped very quickly. You just got to remember that Wall Street is a fixed game. It's like a fixed boxing match where everyone the people that own the fighters know who's going to take a dive, and they've got all of the odds stacked in their favor. Wall Street, it's pretty much exactly the same. Moving on to another big scam, in fact, the decade's biggest scam. Staggering sums of money expended on patently absurd domestic homeland security projects. $75 billion per year for things such as a Zodiac boat with side-scan sonar to respond to a potential attack on a lake in a tiny Keith County, Nebraska, and hundreds of 9-ton Bearcat armored vehicles complete with turret to guard against things like an attack on DreamWorks in Los Angeles. All of that, which is independent of the exponentially greater sum spent on foreign wars, occupations, bombings, and the vast array of weaponry and private contractors to support it all, is in response to this mammoth existential, the single greatest challenge of our generation threat. The number of people worldwide who are killed by Muslim-type terrorists, Al-Qaeda wannabes, is maybe a few hundred outside of war zones. It's basically the same number of people who die drowning in the bathtub each year, said John Mueller, an Ohio State University professor who's written extensively about the balance between threat and expenditures in fighting terrorism. Last year, McClatchy characterized this threat in similar terms. I don't know what McClatchy is. Undoubtedly, more American citizens died overseas from traffic accidents or intestinal illnesses than from terrorism. The March 2011 Harper's Index expressed the point this way. Number of American civilians who died worldwide in terrorist attacks last year, 8. Minimum number who died after being struck by lightning, 29. So basically what this story is about is how the fear of terrorism has been built up and up and up over the last decade. to a point where there is extraordinary sums of money being spent on it, which are of course all going to, you know, private contracting firms, manufacturing firms that all have huge amounts of lobbyists working in Washington to get this sort of stuff passed. And of course, the people are paying for all this. The same people who are facing more and more severe measures in the US, cuts in education, cuts in healthcare, cuts in social welfare, all to pay for these security technologies and forces, which far overwhelm what the real risk is. The LA Times, highlighting these wasteful programs, depicts them as some sort of unintended inefficiencies, but that's exactly what they're not. None of this is unintended or inefficient, but is achieving exactly the purposes for which it's designed. That's true for two reasons, quoting from the article here in Information Clearinghouse News. First, this wastefulness is seen as inefficient only if one falsely assumes that its real objective is to combat terrorist threats. That's not the purpose of what the US government does. As Daniel Weeks explains, the Congress, contrary to popular opinion, isn't broken. It's working perfectly for its actual owners. Or as he puts it, Washington isn't broken, it's fixed. Our problem today is not a broken government, but a beholden one. Government is more beholden to special interest shareholders who fund campaigns than it is to ordinary voters. Like any sound investor, the funders seek nothing more and nothing less than a handsome return, deficits be darned, in the form of tax breaks, subsidies, and government contracts. Meanwhile, much of the anti-terrorism weaponry in the US ends up being deployed for purposes of purely domestic policing. As the LA Times notes, those aforementioned bearcats are now deployed by police across the country. The arrests of methamphetamine dealers and bank robbers these days often look much like a tactical assault on insurgents in Baghdad. Drones are used both in the drug war and to patrol the border. Surveillance measures, originally justified as necessary to fight foreign terrorists, are routinely turned far more often inward. And the NSA, created with a taboo against domestic spying, now does that regularly. Exaggerating, manipulating, and exploiting the terrorist threat for profit and power has been the biggest scam of the decade. Only Wall Street's ability to make the government prop it up and profit from the crisis it created at the expense of everyone else can compete for that title. Nothing has altered the mindset of the American citizenry more than a decade's worth of fear-mongering. So compelling is fear-based propaganda, so beholden are our government institutions to these private security state factions, and so unaccountable is the power bestowed by these programs that even a full decade after the only terrorist attacks on the US soil, its growth continues more or less unabated. So it's important, I think, for us to understand what's really going on. You know, these interests, and, you know, I'm particularly talking about the US, but the same is true to lesser extents in the UK and Australia. You have these interests tied up in funding these sorts of mechanisms. And, you know, there's so much money in it that they have lots of lobbyists and lots of opportunity to contribute to political campaigns. You know, particularly now in the US, that the Supreme Court has removed any limits to corporate contributions to political campaigns, it's just open slather. The government is not run by and for the benefit of the people. It's run by and for the benefit of these private interests. And that needs to change. Last story for today, then I got to go do some work. Christian wants atheist registry. Florida pastor Michael Stahl has suggested that an organization and website be created that would keep track of known atheists. The website would list by city and state all atheists with their photos and some personal information such as place of business. It would not include a physical address, which seems to contradict one of the main purposes of the site. Pastor Mike compares atheists to convicted sex offenders, ex-convicts, terrorist cells, hate groups like the KKK, skinheads, radical Islamists, etc. He claims that the purpose of this organization, called the Christian National Registry of Atheists, is to inform the public of known atheists so that they can be proselytized to, excuse me, and their businesses can be boycotted. So this is an interesting turn of events. Just the very idea that there should be a registry of atheists who can be targeted. Obviously, I don't think it would happen in Australia, as per our earlier story about the decline in religion. But interesting to even see this suggested in the US. As religion becomes more and more indefensible in the light of science and logic and rational thinking, how extreme are the fundamentalists prepared to get in Western countries to try and disenfranchise and terrorize the non-believers? Be interesting to see how that progresses. Well, that's the show for today. Thanks for listening. Love to get your feedback on Twitter. Twitter ID is just Cameron Riley, R-E-I-O-O-Y. Send me an email, CameronRiley@gmail.com or Cameron@thepodcastnetwork.com. And if you have any feedback on the show, would love to hear it. Any questions or anything you'd like me to talk about in future shows, let me know. Thanks, folks. Stay safe. And remember, if things are going to change, it's going to be up to us.
It's your Uncle Snoop Dogg, man. We got to put this Uncle Snoop's army together, man. Because you know me, I'm an opportunist, man. I love giving opportunity, you dig it? So what I'm going to do, I'm going to kick it off like I know how. And then we going to let them come in and do what they do. Because I got to let you know how it is, dude.
This is music for the grown folks. Feet tapping and free clapping the horn notes. Patron floats and Hennessy getting ordered up. You order cups while a bottle's headed for the guts. We skunked up and funked up with speakers jumping, people pumping fists, saying bartender, keep them coming. A decent woman got a vertebrae percolating, working the dance floor and every move is earthquaking. The perk blazing with heads nodding and bobbing. Reds watching the bottoms just dropping it to the bottom. Not stopping the rocking beat, knocking from the headhunters. Heads hunting something for cutting and doing bad stunting. Yeah, we just trying to have a good time with good vibes, highs wanting a good rhyme. You should climb up in VIP so you can groove to the tools just to be like me. Bang.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Come on with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Come on with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Come on with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Yeah, we taking over the stage after rolling the blaze and it's gone to the face. Stone to the bone and the bone on some haze with the song going strong and the flows in the craze. Blunt hind, 55 with Summers and Clark. Drunk drumming and strumming gives a wonderful spark. And everybody is feeling us, they on the same page. Flame Jane and Jägermeister laced with Bane. The bass is made to solely move souls and souls. No control needed for this part of the show. The harder we go, the more that y'all getting into it. To this music that we do in the mood of little cuties booties. Yeah, this the track full of rap. Funk, jazz, and sax, all mixing the crap. We listen and clap, put your blunts high and your cups up. Let's have a good time and all get funked up.
No, we be the keepers of the frequency with headphones on the wrong song. Frequently we don't see. We do it, we dance to it. But to the beat, controlled by that different drum, we're peaking, positively tweaking, freeing ourselves of the need to be free. You dig it?
That dog don't fuck with us.
Come on with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Come and fuck with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Come on with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
I play it cool. Listen to the beat so smooth. Get in the groove and do what it do. Get the bud inside the soul. Then grab a brew. Then act the fool, but stay masterful. Preach like a gypsy. Now with rosters and hippies. Drake got me tipsy off the whiskey. Getting busy. Bearing steps out the mothership. I face on Mars. This place is ours amongst the great stars with great bars. I'm like a Martian marching from Stockton all the way to Slauson. The granddaddy perp got me watching Papa Smurf. Weed and fireworks, the party's berserk. Yep. So listen to this verse. Throw on your flies dress shirt. Find a girl in the network.
Come and fuck with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Come on with us.
Who said that dog don't fuck with us?
Yeah, that's the business.
Matter of fact, that's the mandatory business. With this real business, man, the Bay Area, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, you know, Fillmore, Munzigan and Oakland, yeah, Richmond, even them Munzigan and Fresno, I see y'all, Sacramento, yeah. Baby said she was from Hayward, so I guess I'ma go there. It is what it is, cuz I'm with the Bay. Who said the dog wasn't with y'all? They bullshit. Cause you know I'm with y'all. I've been with y'all. I'm with all this from this way, man. I'm a Eastside Long Beach 20 crib, but I'm with the Bay. Yeah.